Hi, I'm Bunny Guinness, and this is my podcast, Bunny in the Garden, with someone special. Someone who is well known for something other than their green fingers, but who is also a mustard-keen gardener. I'll discover them through their garden, why, how, and when they garden, the best tips they've learnt, and their gardening style and approach. So today I'm thrilled to be in the garden with Guy Singh Watson. Guy is arguably the best known organic farmer and veg grower in the UK. He hit the headlines when he sold Riverford, the largest boxed veg scheme in the UK, to his staff. The price was set at around a quarter of what accountants told him it was worth, but he wanted to avoid burdening the business with debt. It's great to have you on, Guy. You've always been really generous with your time, helpfully responding to any veg queries that I've often had over the years. But just to sort of skip through your life, you started the business on 3 acres with a wheelbarrow and a tractor. And were you organic from the word go?
No, I mean, my parents were tenant farmers, Church of England tenants. They weren't organic, but they probably had a leaning in that direction. Well, my father certainly did. So that was back in 1987. I sowed my first leeks in that field. And it was, literally a wheelbarrow and a tractor borrowed off my brother and selling to local shops from the back of my car. So it was very humble beginnings.
But it is very difficult. I mean, in my year off after my hort degree, before I started the landscape architecture, I grew vegetables and sold them. And I have to say, it is probably one of the most difficult things that you can try and do. A, there's all the things with growing them, the problems and finding out about them. It's not a quick process always. And also it's marketing them. So you did choose two really different difficult things. And although you had done a degree in agriculture from Oxford, that hardly equips you to growing leeks and radishes, does it?
No, and I was pretty ignorant. I mean, I'd helped my mother in the garden quite a lot. We'd grown a few lettuces on the farm and swedes, sell to local wholesalers, but yeah, really not a lot of veg experience. And that, you know, I can hardly believe this, but when my mother hated Brussels sprouts, and so when I planted my first Brussels sprouts, they could have grown into a tree and been picked like apples for all I knew. And when they arrived in those sort of helical, you know, pattern up the stem, I was absolutely, it was a complete surprise to me. So that's how ignorant I was about that. You know, the Royal Horticultural Society's annual gardening book was kind of my Bible. And at that time, you could get advice from ADAS. Very hard. This was before Margaret Thatcher dismantled any sort of such support. And someone used to come out and visit me once a month, and he was also very helpful, though he always was encouraging me to use pesticides.
I worked for ADAS in my year out, and I have to say, they were amazing, weren't they? And in America, you still have the what are they called? The Agricultural Extension. And it's an organisation in all the different areas that advises farmers and horticulture, supported by the government. And it gives amazing advice. I love dipping into that.
Yeah, I mean, it was absolutely invaluable. And so, you know, now we have, so that was getting on for 40 years ago.
Yeah.
And it's all been dismantled. And then yesterday, you know, Rishi Sunak had a meeting in Number 10 about, you know, encouraging in particular fruit and vegetable growing. Well, you know, one of the absolute key things is knowledge. And all farmers are far too prone to just staying on their farms and putting their heads down rather than going out and seeing what other people are doing. So I think that's something the industry desperately needs is help with developing and sharing best practice.
Oh, yeah, I can't believe it's ever going to happen, sadly. But sadly. I totally agree with you there. So you were the youngest of five. You were born in 1960 and your mother had children. She popped them out every 18 months. She had 9 months hatching them, 9 months off.
That's
so you were obviously self-willed, strong-willed. Were you spoiled being the youngest lad?
Oh, you'd have to ask my siblings. I can't imagine. I can't imagine anyone being spoiled in our family. It was a pretty, you earned your place at the table by virtue of what value you'd created that day, you know, how many calves you'd fed or pigs you'd mucked out or whatever. So I'd spoil is not a word I would use, but I did perhaps, I might have been the apple of my mother's eye. I don't know. It has been suggested by siblings. I was never really aware of it myself. I always felt confident that I was loved. So maybe that in some people's language equates to being spoiled.
Okay, no, you probably weren't. And you were given a pig for your 8th birthday.
I
Amazing.
was.
Now, what I did find extraordinary was that you said you never felt any guilt eating your produce, because every time, so we have the odd pig, cow, chicken, everything, sheep. And I always say, when I eat the first dish of the beast that's on the table that you've cooked, I find it gut-wrenchingly difficult. Now, you will probably say how hypocritical, because she carries on eating them for the next few months, but I equate it with the fact that, you've given it a pretty good life. Hopefully they're not stocked densely, and hopefully you've given it as pleasant as dispatchment as possible. But how do you do that? So you literally could bite your way into porky or whatever it's called, and you wouldn't feel any sentiment.
Yeah, no, I ate a lamb which I bottle reared, and he was called Henry, and it didn't bother me at all, actually. And I am currently eating my way through a lamb which grew one of our neighbors grew in one of our fields, and it doesn't. I don't know whether that makes me a cold-hearted son of a bitch, either, but
Well,
no,
we
I.
are just hypocritical, aren't we? Because most of the country eat meat, and we don't know where it's reared, how it's dispatched, and we enjoy it.
Well,
But
I mean, we're all, we're a nation, probably a globe of hypocrites. I remember going to a battery chicken farm with a bunch of agricultural students, and these were agricultural students. And when we walked out of the shed, at least 50% of them were in tears. And I thought, well, how did you think your eggs were produced? I mean, that's been banned now, quite rightly so, but it is, we do choose, and I have to say, I think we choose not to see the reality of agriculture, and that is quite frustrating as a
It's
farmer.
greed. Don't you think it's just greed? Because we're greedy, we want more for less, and that we seem to have a never-ending desire to have a better standard of living and beat the guy next door. I mean, it seems to be ingrained in us, and
No, I
forget.
don't agree with that at all. I don't think it is greed. I think it's laziness, and it's laziness aided and abetted by an industry that actually doesn't want to tell us the truth about how our food is produced.
Well, I just think that this whole consumerism is sort of on a hell bent to destruction thing. We're encouraged with marketing to consume as much as we can, and we appreciate a better. We all want a better standard of living all the time, and I just don't think there's
Well,
an end to it.
is it a better standard of living? I mean, it's absurd. I mean, anyone who thinks all those extra things is going to make them happy. I mean, sure, if you're living on the breadline and you have no choices, a bit more money and a few more choices, almost certainly would aid your happiness. But, for most people, sorry, but anyway, those that are on my sort of earnings are, it won't make a blind bit of difference.
So, growing up on a tenant farm, being severely dyslexic, I was amazed that you then managed to get to Oxford. That's a pretty amazing thing to do, isn't it? To study agricultural and forestry.
Yeah, no, it was pretty extraordinary. And when I've handed in my first bit of work at Oxford, it was handed right back to me. So you can't hand in work like that. Somehow I was very, very dyslexic, but I went to an absolutely brilliant primary school, and I think I was so lucky, really, not to be brandished as a failure, because I think so many people would have done. I think I do have a kind of streak of, I'm going to call it arrogance. That I don't think anyone's any better than me, and I don't care whether they can write better than me. I'm not going to be beaten by that. But I know that that isn't the case for many people at school. I mean, having that sort of, I'm going to call it neurodiversity, condemns many people to failing in life, which I think is absolutely tragic, because it's just a difference. It's not a disability, it's a difference.
And at what point did you become more academic? So obviously to get to Oxford, you became academic. And at what I just noticed with a lot of boys, my own son included, that they don't actually develop that competitive, almost academic streak until quite late on, much later than girls. And what point did that switch click, or didn't that happen? And you thought, right, I'm going to go for it.
Well, actually, I think it probably kind of happened when I went from this absolutely brilliant, sort of fairly liberal state primary school to a comprehensive. And, because my writing and stuff was appalling, I got put in the bottom stream for everything. And I knew that I was smarter than that. And that just kind of seemed to galvanize. My father always said it was the making of me. And I said, no, damn this, I'm going to prove you that I can do better. And within 2 or 3 years, I climbed my way up through the school and got pretty good GCSEs and O levels in those days, and went on. So I think it was that, it was I had an almost unhealthy need to prove myself, and I had my own rules really for what proving myself was. I wasn't going to accept other people's rules. So I think I was quite sort of unusual that, but for entrepreneurs, that need to sort of prove yourself is actually very common. And it's amazing the number of entrepreneurs that I meet who had fathers who withheld their approval. I mean, my father did finally give it to me on his deathbed when he pulled me in close and said, "Son, you've done well." But I mean, I would have never known. It took him 94, it
And
took
with
him
your
4 years.
sons, have you got similarly driven sons or daughters? And do you give them, you see, maybe it's a good thing the fact they never gave us approval. Maybe that's what spurs us
Well,
all on. And
my
now we all say,
father.
you're wonderful, darling. Perhaps it's actually not such a good thing.
Perhaps you're throwing some very unfashionable views at me, Bunny. But I think
Yes.
there is something in that. My father would have certainly agreed with you. And I have a Ugandan friend who's a farmer, and he definitely he thinks to spoil your children, you will make them stubborn. I mean, they have this way of raising their children, which, from my observation of him and his children, actually doesn't really seem to have done them any harm. I mean, they don't seem emotionally stunted. But to answer your question, with my children, I do try quite hard not to make the mistakes of my father. However, I can't help noticing that they still, I think all of them, do feel judged by me, just however hard I try not
Yeah.
to. So I'm probably giving out that vibe, even though I try hard not to. Yeah.
And do you give them pocket money, or do you give them pigs to make money from?
Well, they've all left home. I think they did have some pretty minimal pocket money, but they were all, working from quite a young age. And
Yeah.
actually, there's still my sons, who are 24 and 26, do still come back. One is coming back next month to do these foraging for marsh samphire. That'll be his, and wild garlic is also something that they come back for 6 weeks every year and make quite a lot of money. Pays for their surfing trips.
Right. Oh, that sounds really good. Yeah. So you got to Oxford, and then turning your back on the life as a country boy, you went on to become a management consultant. Now, if I could think of two more extreme jobs, that would be management consultancy and farming. But actually, has the management consultancy stood you in good stead? Because obviously you are a phenomenal, can't say the word, but you know what I mean, businessman, as well as a good grower. And that is pretty unusual in agriculture.
I think it gave me a glimpse. I did it for a couple of years in London and then in New York. And it gave me a glimpse into the brutality of global markets, and really led me to conclude that just thinking because you're doing something well, that you'll be okay if you're just efficient and work hard. I mean, it's just rubbish. There's always someone in the world who that can do it cheaper than you, and the only thing that that gives you some assurance of your future is to have control over your product and how it's presented and sold and to who and at what price. And in the UK, that means not selling through a supermarket because there is virtually no branded produce, a fresh produce on the supermarket shelves. They make damn sure, so they have all the power. And you're just a commodity producer, and that's just had absolutely dire consequences for British farming, which is absolutely on its knees at the moment. 49% of fruit and vegetable growers think they won't be in business next year.
No, it's appalling. And horticulture, definitely. So many problems there. I loved your quote when you said that supermarket buyers make secondhand car sellers seem like priests.
Yeah,
And my mum
by
dealt
that.
with supermarkets, and she would thoroughly endorse that, as I would think most growers would. But they continue to rule, don't they? They're a massive outlet, and a lot of growers could not survive without them. But no, it does create massive, massive problems. It's interesting talking to you about what you grow and things. And I think what I found really interesting was that you said that you didn't grow tomatoes with heat. If you grew tomatoes in the UK with heated greenhouses, which many, many commercial growers do, I've worked in them, and to get that longer season, they heat at either ends. But from carbon footprint, your Riverford tomatoes are grown in Spain if necessary and shipped across. And you say that they should not be flown or grown in heated greenhouses.
I mean, the two insanities in fresh produce are air freight and heated glass. I mean, a pepper grown in the UK using heated glass would have roughly 10 times the carbon footprint of one grown in the south of Spain and trucked, or south of Italy and trucked. That would typically have a carbon footprint of about 400 grams per kilo, which is, not ideal. I mean, obviously, it would be much better if we didn't eat peppers outside of the UK season, but the UK season is about 3 months if you're lucky, so that would, I think most British people just wouldn't accept that. So, yeah, we, based on that research, which was done by Exeter University on our behalf, we have, I mean, that must be, I think that was back in 2007. We haven't bought anything from heated glass since, even though, we gave our growers two or 3 years to we told them that we weren't going to continue buying from them. And today you maybe use combined heat and power, the heat from generating electricity, the waste heat, and that, will reduce your carbon footprint somewhat. But I mean, you think that this is a single glazed glass house, which is heated to 20 degrees C when you plant the tomatoes, January, February. That would be illegal, it to build a house. Building regs would outlaw that. It would have to be double glazed, and you'd have to have, do a whole energy profile of the building. And yet, we actually, one of the things of Rishi Sunak's was talking about energy costs to growers. I hope to God that he's not going to subsidize fossil fuel use for heated glass. I mean, that would just be absurd. I mean, it should be illegal. I mean, we shouldn't be subsidizing it, we should be banning it. And if that means that we double glaze greenhouses, or use, clever inflated plastic greenhouses, or import from Spain, but whatever, we just can't carry on with that insane use of fossil fuels given the climate crisis that's facing us.
I mean, there are lots of new developments, like the ETFE, isn't it? The double glazed ETFE polythenes, which let all the light rays through.
Well, I met the guy who invented that the other day, and it does sound a pretty phenomenal technology. That's, anyone who's visited the Eden Project, that's how, they are, and obviously that's going to increase your thermal efficiency
Yeah.
massively. One would have
I've
to do
got coal
that.
frames with that, not double, but single of that.
Right.
And it is amazing because it lets all the rays through. The
Yeah.
plants are far less stressed, and it with the double glazing of it, you get phenomenal insulation.
Yeah.
And then I've also got a partially sunken greenhouse, so I will have tomatoes, and I'll be picking tomatoes right up to December with no heat, but the smaller varieties.
Yeah.
And so I don't buy literally any tomatoes because I don't then eat from December to about June, July when they start coming in.
Well, well
But
done.
sorry.
I said, well done. Yeah, no, because
Yeah.
the those ones, those November, December, January tomatoes are just not worth opening your mouth for. I mean,
To buy them, but my homegrown
I mean,
ones,
if you can leave, I
yeah.
suppose if you can leave yours to fully ripen in the greenhouse, they might be better. But generally, the ones that are grown, with heat to let them ripen, but without the sunshine, because there's not a lot of sunshine in the UK at that time of year, they're just, I mean, yeah, pretty
Well,
hideous.
mine taste good, Guy. They really do. Much better than anything I could buy in the supermarket. But I think variety is a difference. And don't forget, I'm right over the east, so we have probably more sunlight than you, I would say.
Regrettably, I'd have to concede that,
Yes,
yeah.
most definitely. you then remarried, and I just think it's lovely that you've taken on your wife's surname. That is really unusual, isn't it?
Yeah, but you haven't met my wife. That was really nice.
Idea was it, yours or her? So you're now Sing
I
Watson. I
can't
knew you as
remember.
Watson.
I can't remember how, but we settled on it very amicably. And Sing Watson, I like it. It's and I love her. She's half her family were from the Punjab, and her father,
Yes.
and many of whom I've met and been to some of the Sikh weddings and stuff. And it's a wonderful culture, and enriching to be at least on the periphery of it.
But you are a first in that as well. I know of no other man who has taken on his wife's surname as well. Do you? That is un it's really
Actually,
unusual.
yeah, I suppose I don't I yeah I guess I don't know anyone. My wife's pretty unconventional. She said, prior to us meeting, there was no way she was ever going to marry. There was a dreadful institution and so on, and I did manage to persuade her to move down here from London. So I felt she was giving up quite a lot, and maybe the least I could do was to demonstrate my commitment by taking her name as she was taking mine.
I think it's a great story. I really do. I wouldn't ever want to keep mine on because it's a ghastly surname. So I was very happy to change it, I have to say. But the other thing I liked about your wife was that her nickname was the rabbit
Oh
because of
yes,
her love of raw leaves and legumes.
oh, you've really done your research, haven't you? Yeah,
I've really done my well, with rabbit and bunny, you
she
know.
grew up in a commune in Herefordshire and just always loved vegetables. So, it was a very fortunate meeting, actually. We did really fall for each other in a field of radicchio. We both particularly like bitter flavors, and we argued about whether one should eat the outer leaves of the radicchio or not. By the time we left the field, it was no, we'd pretty much fallen for each other, I think.
Got all over radicchio, but why would you not eat the outer leaves of radicchio to leave out the sex bit?
Well, they can be a bit furry, and if you've got a whole field of them, why not just take the very best?
You wasteful man. You wasteful man. I'm totally on the other side there. But anyway, and I often think, but with many vegetables, and maybe not radicchio, but with potatoes and carrots and parsnips and globe artichokes, no, not globe, but Jerusalem artichokes, if you're eating the skin and the outer bits, there's an awful lot there that we did normally discard, and it's
Well, that is true.
painful.
So, yeah, I mean, for the lettuces, all the nutrition is in the outer. So an iceberg lettuce, by the time you get into the heart of it, has no nutritional value
Is that
whatsoever.
right?
No, all the vitamins and minerals are in the green leaves around the outside.
Oh, I didn't realize that. Yeah, I always remember working with Raymond Blanc, and he says whenever he has potatoes at home, he mashes them with the peel on. And ever since then, I've done that, and they taste wonderful. But he says he could not serve them up in a Michelin-star restaurant like that because the hunters would go, "Oh my God, what are those bits in it?"
Well, I think he
But
should have the courage of his convictions and go. But having said that, well, that's another thing I've argued with Geeti, my wife, about. She has, yeah, we don't peel potatoes anymore.
so which side were you on with that one
Well,
then?
actually, I roast potatoes. I like them, when you fluff them up, having boiled them, and that doesn't work. You don't get quite such a crispy one if you peel them. But I still think it's not worth peeling them. And yeah, as you
No.
said, personally, it's better, and waste-wise, it's better, and flavor-wise, it's
Time.
better.
Time,
Time
time,
and
time.
time.
So you're both cooks, aren't you? Because I get the impression that you're really keen on your food and cooking.
I
And
love
so do
cooking.
you fight in the kitchen?
No, actually, we're very amicable. We do when we entertain. We're pretty good at getting a meal on the table for six or eight people in a couple of hours, and I do most of the cooking. Geeti loves; she has a passion for crockery and stuff and table setting, no, I tend to do most of the cooking, and she gives me her order for supper every night, and I have to cook it. She's very, very particular about her food and what she wants, and she can't tell me until at least 5 o'clock what it is she needs tonight, and I better cook it the way she likes it, or there will be trouble.
So you rush out to the fields, gather it all, forage it from the woods, zoom back in. I'm surprised you have time to do anything else.
It's
And
my
so what would...
unwind. At the end of the day, I do. It's my unwind is to cook. I mean, I do, and I don't have a huge repertoire. I mean, I very, very happily cook the same. I think most people have sort of 10
Yeah.
three six sort of standard things, of which there will be variations, and I'm no different really. I will occasionally branch out, but I normally come back to my regular 10 fairly quickly.
And your signature dish?
Oh, blimey, I don't know. Something would have to be something with artichokes, I suppose, fried artichokes or artichokes with peas, I love, and a bit of mint,
We're
which would
talking
be nice.
globe artichokes
Yeah,
here.
talk, yeah, but sorry,
Yeah.
globe artichokes, and these would be the baby ones, chopped up and fried in olive oil, finished with some peas and mint.
So it's a golf ball size artichoke.
Yeah.
Variety, what variety?
Well, the one we grow is Madrigal, but though if you are going to, that's really better for the large ones. If anyone wants to grow them just for the baby ones to cook in this way, you're better off with one of the violet varieties. They tend to be more tender. The one that we've got is Opal, OPAL.
Yeah.
And I can't remember the names of the other ones. These are all hybrids now.
The F1 hybrids, yeah. Yeah, so you can grow them from seed.
I have grown. Yes, we well, actually, we don't anymore. We take the suckers off the plants and propagate them from them because I'm too
Yeah.
mean by the seeds. We have grown the open pollinated ones, but you and they look fantastic in the field. I mean, they're even such beautiful things. Just makes you want to, paint them and whatever. But they are everything from a thistle to a, highly bred one and everything in between. So
Yeah.
you just weigh from a commercial point of view, it's pretty hopeless growing an open pollinated artichoke. We grow mostly hybrids.
But you can buy the F1 seed of opal and things, is what I'm saying, can't you? Madrigal.
Oh
Yeah,
yeah, you
yeah,
can. You
yeah.
can
I'm just
and grow
thinking for
them from
punters who
seed.
haven't got them. Yeah.
Yes. I think next year we will probably be selling our own suckers. One of my staff here on the farm is setting up his business selling perennials. So, things like the cardoons, the artichokes, rhubarb, raspberries, strawberries, and so on, we will be selling.
Oh, that's interesting. That will go down the saw, because I think many people love perennial vegetables who haven't got time to,
Yeah.
repeat sow things and things like that. That's a good
Yeah, no.
sideline.
Yeah, no, I think I'm absolutely hugely enthusiastic about perennial vegetables. In fact, we have incredible vegetables here. Mandy Barber's business on our farm, and she's probably the UK's leading expert on perennials. And anyone, I mean, to have a couple of perennial kale plants in your garden, and you'll have greens, available to you, fresh as you like, for 10 years from just one planting. I mean, it is rather than the effort of constantly sowing and, and re-sowing, the perennials have such huge advantages. And any sort of pick and come again vegetables like, perpetual spinach or chard or, even some of the salads that you can just carry on picking rather than having to sow every week. It's got to be easier.
Yeah, no, I quite agree. I do grow marsh samphire, but in a pot, keeping it very moist and giving it a wee bit of saline, which is a perennial, isn't it, obviously, but
Wow.
you wouldn't use huge quantities
Well,
of
marsh
it.
samphire, I don't think, the stuff that we forage is certainly annual. It comes back from seed every year. You may have a different type. It's definitely not rock samphire,
No,
because that's
it's definitely
perennial.
marsh samphire. Yeah.
Okay. I didn't know that. And and the seed is like talcum powder. Did you grow it from seed?
No, I didn't. I bought a
Okay.
plant. Yeah,
Yeah.
from Jimmy's farm. He had it on his garden centre. Did you know Jimmy from Jimmy's farm?
He visited us a few years ago to do some filming.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
No, I've never been to his farm.
You, have just got a new cottage garden and you're going to get to grips on it. So obviously you have very green fingers, don't you? You must have grown just about every vegetable under the sun in big quantity. But the ornamental side of this, so what is your vision? And just describe this plot that you've got waiting to be transformed, and your vision of how you're going to do it and what it's going to look like. And what you're going to do in it?
Well, I'm 64 now and I am sort of edging towards retirement. I am working less,
I'm
but
sorry that I cannot believe that. I cannot be believe you will ever be on the lounger.
I feel it beckoning. I just can't do the physical anymore. A couple hours a day and I've had enough now. Anyway, so my parents, we used to go drive to the coast south from the farm, to this lovely little cove, which was my dad's favourite beach. And he used to tell, when he'd finished milking the cows in the morning, he'd pile us all into a Morrissey 1100 Traveller, and we'd drive down there, spend the day on the beach. Then he'd come back and milk the cows. And there were a family of fishermen who ran crab boats off the beach, and we got to know them. And my mum, a fantastic cook, she always bought a crab or a lobster when we came home. And I've known that family. That was back in the 60s. I've known them all my life. And the last of them died, sadly, or the last of them that lived in the cottage above the beach died last year. And their family, his family, asked if we'd like to buy the cottage. And we did.
Oh, lovely. So you've known
And the
it all
plan
your
being,
life.
yeah, it's, and I know loads of the people who also use the beach and all the neighbours and so on. And it's very, very remote down a bumpy track, but it sits right above this beach. It's just heaven. And
So
it
what?
was handed by, it was going back 50 years, all the fields around there where you grew new potatoes, some of the earliest land in the UK. And indeed, the valley running up behind the house is terraced, and you go back further, and they used to grow vegetables on the terraces. And it was, so it has an incredible heritage. And the fishermen used to grow vegetables in front of the house, and I'm hoping to carry on his growing.
I was going
And
to ask that. So you.
he grew quite a few ornamentals as well, which I'm kind of less interested in. There's still lots of lovely irises coming back at the moment. I do like an iris.
Oh, yeah, they're lovely, especially now. My irises are just blooming beautifully. So, how many meters have you got from your front door to the top of the cliff? I imagine you're like 20 meters above the sea, are you?
It's rather distressingly close, actually, and it is slipping away. So it's 150 steps from our door to the sea.
Meter steps or
No, little steps.
those
Less than,
70 centimeters probably. So
no.
about 100 meters then.
It's probably a bit less.
Oh, that's nice. So in that space, what is your vision for that space?
Well, we've already planted a few things down there, or rather Geetie has, and a gale will come in and you come back and they're dead. Because you get a lot of salt spray coming up off the beach. And so
So
I think
what did you say she'd planted in there?
there were some rosemary and some herbs that we'd
Oh,
planted,
right.
and
Yeah.
that was not happy at all. Though I think you have to really get a feel for, there are little niches you can create, little sheltered bits by walls and behind bushes and so on, but you can't try and fight what nature's throwing at you, which I slightly worry that, I mean, Geetie took down some clematis last weekend. I don't think that's got hope. So I actually love it. The flowers that you see on the cliff path and on the cliff, and just the windblown thorns, I just think are wonderful themselves. So I would like to create a garden that sort of celebrates and mimics the nature around us, rather than trying to impose something more formal, which I think would probably be doomed. I have
Well,
planted some
things
asparagus.
like sea kale,
Well,
crambie
and we
would
have,
be.
I did plant an asparagus bed down there. So I'm hoping that, when we move down permanently in a few years, that I will at least have plenty of asparagus.
And something like, is it the Scottish rose, Spinosifolia? Is it that little one with the very divided leaves? It's very tough. I'm sure that would
Okay.
probably.
All right.
Oh,
Well, maybe we, No, I think it's trying to find the things that are happy in that environment. I mean, just as farming all my life, I just love growing crops that actually are happy
yeah.
growing in our climate, as opposed to struggling. And and then you inevitably use a lot of inputs to try and make a crop that's outside its comfort zone, and I think that's the problem with, I see all my neighbors sowing maize at the moment, a lot of them putting clear plastic down on the ground, which will pollute the soil with microplastics for decades to come, to grow a crop, which it basically doesn't like growing in the UK. It's too cold, so let's grow grass for our cows instead of maize, and then we wouldn't have to use all these inputs.
I just remember in the 60s it came in with the new varieties and everybody could grow sweet corn in the UK, whereas before we couldn't. It's a C4 plant, isn't it? So it converts its chlorophyll and the carbohydrates much more efficiently than many plants.
when it gets above a certain, it just takes off, you know, and it
Yeah.
grows very quickly. And yeah, so, you know, in a good summer, it can do well, but it does require, you know, very high inputs. And to get it harvested reasonably early, you know, increasingly people are putting this degradable plastic down
Oh,
to
right.
help warm the soil. And
Yeah.
it's just, and that it's not compostable, it's just degradable, so it just breaks up into micro plastic. So
Yeah.
we're intentionally, you know, polluting our soils and our water supply with these microplastics, and no one ever talks about it. You know, we ban plastic straws and whatever. I mean, it's just, and we continue doing this, you know, intentionally to feed dairy cows, and it is a high energy diet, and dairy cows do very well on it. But they, you know, you can grow a whole crop silage, you know, which is what my brother does, and undersow it with grass, and it's a very good system. Produces almost as much yield. It doesn't leave the soil exposed to erosion and soil damage over the winter, which almost inevitably is a result of late harvesting of maize. I mean, the Environment Agency are just pulling their hair out about maize, and it's you can cut me off or edit this out because it is a bit of a bee in my bonnet. And we are paying, a lot of it is grown, or a fair amount of it is grown, to go into anaerobic digesters, you know, to produce supposedly green electricity, which we subsidize through our green tariffs. I mean, it's completely absurd.
So apart from the plastic covers to warm up the soil, a lot of gardeners are using fleece, and I bet Riverford use fleece, don't they, on
We
all
do
sorts
use,
of crops,
yeah,
which
we
is
do use.
just pretty bad for the environment, isn't it? But I don't know how I would garden without fleece.
Well, the advantage of fleece, I mean, particularly in a domestic setting, is that you can use it over and over again.
But not forever. I mean,
Not forever.
after five, six outings, it's pretty thin fleece with holes in.
Yeah, that's a fair comment. And we have done a carbon footprint, pretty rough one, of the use of fleece, and it came out in very rough figures. It depends on the crop, but it was much, much better than importing vegetables. So we tend to use it at the beginning of the season to advance crops, and compared to importing vegetables from Spain, it's clearly the environmentally better thing to
Right.
do in terms
Yeah.
of carbon and climate change. I mean, you do have the material to you know, dispose of at the end. It's to my knowledge not recyclable. Yeah, that is, it's far from perfect.
Yeah.
But you know, people are going to eat out season vegetables, and it's that, or importing them, or growing them in a heated greenhouse.
It's not just for out of season that I use it. I use it to keep things off. I mean, I do find now growing vegetables now compared to 40, 50 years ago, you know, I've got onion fly, leek moth, I've got all sorts of aphids, flea beetles. And so to
We
increase the
are.
humidity with the flea beetles, I find fleece
That's true.
helps that.
You
I mean,
might find that some of the net materials are better for some of those problems. The problem with fleece as you get into the summer is it actually gets too warm underneath it,
And
and
then I
some of.
switch to a net. Yeah.
You know that. So
Yeah.
they, which are more durable, and you might get 10 or 20 years out of the net. So we use, for our salad leaves when we're growing rocket and mizuna and so on, where flea beetle is a pretty major problem, we are typically covering those with fleeces up until, you know, through April. As soon as we get much into May, we'll switch to net.
Yeah. No, it is. I mean, that is now when you grow vegetables, how you manage them totally organically. Is there anything that you grow with no covers that you can grow that doesn't get carrot fly, that doesn't get pigeoned?
No, the huge majority of our carrots are not covered with nets. We did, and carrot fly being the major issue, but you just have to avoid, you want a pretty windswept field, and don't plant the headlands. And you know, because the carrot fly is a tiny little fly, and it and in an open field. I mean, I'm not saying always, but normally on the top of a hill in Devon, you will get very little carrot fly. In a valley and in the eddies around the hedgerows and so on, yes, it can be devastating. But that seems to keep the carrot fly mostly at bay. We couldn't grow salad leaves without covering them. That's certainly true. They would just all look like someone had been out there with a 12 bore and emptied a box of cartridges on them. So I mean, things like cabbage root fly with cauliflowers is a problem, but again, we do seem to have found ways around it, areas where that are less susceptible. It's not something that is a major issue for us.
But
But it
your
seems to be.
cauliflower, though, I remember talking to you about cauliflowers years back, and you said, because you've got a farm next to me in the East Midlands at Sacwell, and you said you grow them in your more maritime farms, not at Sacwell, because the conditions are just not great for cauliflowers.
I mean, the cauliflowers from when frost is likely, so from December to the end of March, will mostly be grown in along the coast where the influence of the warm air tends to keep frost at bay. So most of our ones now are grown by Kathy Case, who comes from a many generations family of cauliflower growers down near Bigbury, south of us on the coast, and they do a fantastic job and very seldom suffer frost damage. So, and typically a lot of the cauliflowers will come from West Cornwall, west of Hale, and there's still quite a vibrant cauliflower and winter brassica industry down there. The Isle of Thanet in Kent, I think bits of Essex where they're sort of protected, the Thames estuary also. But sadly, I mean, a lot of them are also imported at that time of year.
So I have to say that I think cauliflowers are one of the problems. We get asked more questions about on Gardener's Question Time than anything. But I did, when I grew them in a tunnel, they were amazing. I had absolutely no problems with them at all. So, or under a netting, as it were. So, and with my carrots, I grow them in a raised bed so I get no carrot fly. And then you can get them year round now, can't you? Beautiful homegrown carrots, which I really like.
Yeah, we would be on we're on Italian carrots at the moment. We find that we can store them through to the end of April, but then
Store them or just have them in the field with a
the
mulch on the top to protect them
No,
from the frost.
most of ours are actually lifted in the autumn and cold stored, and they will taste better that way than leaving them in the field.
Oh, really? I didn't appreciate that.
No, you harvest them, and you harvest them with a fair amount of earth, and they go into a 1-ton bin, and it's into cold store, and they'll be kept at just above freezing, hopefully below 1 degree centigrade at high humidity. And you can keep them through with a really good, well-regulated store. You can keep them reliably through to April, and then just quite quickly their quality deteriorates, and that's when we go to. Occasionally, we'll have a few Scottish carrots at the end of April, and then we go to Italian or sometimes Spanish, which used to be dreadful. But by working with the growers, we have got them. They are producing varieties which are really pretty tasty now. And then we'll be back into, so that's just about 6 weeks, and we're back into UK carrots in at some point in June, though I'm not sure we will be this year because with the wet weathers.
Or cold and wet. Yeah,
And
absolutely.
anyone trying to harvest carrots last winter, using the, they cover the bed in plastic and then they put straw on top of that, and then they put another layer of plastic on top of that. And that, you're putting a kind of duvet under them, and that'll keep the frost off them. And then you have lots of machinery which will strip all that off and then harvest the carrots. But I mean, we're talking mega machinery, and in a wet weather, I imagine that those growers have had a very challenging winter getting those carrots. Even on sandy land, I think it would have been difficult this year.
But on my raised beds, you see, with my carrots over winter, a raised bed keeps them warmer. So, at 60 centimeters, it's warmer than on the ground. So I'm less vulnerable to frost. B, I'm not trampling the ground because they're raised beds. And so I think for a domestic grower like myself, and I would never lift and store them in your temperature-controlled stores because I wouldn't have those facilities. So for the amateur, I think it works really well like that.
I mean, a traditional clamp, kept would you'd keep them through, you might keep them to February or
But you
March. I
have to
mean,
lift them. For
all
me, who hasn't got much time, I just want to dash
right,
out, pull up a
okay,
few carrots, put them in the pan.
No, I can see that, and then if you If you're in a real Oxfordshire or something, which probably has the worst frosts, that might be challenging. But even then, you could cover them. Yes, no, but I mean, raised beds are brilliant for domestic gardeners. I wish I could turn my whole farm into a raised bed.
Charles Darding would disagree massively. But anyway, I'm a
It,
raised
well, he
bed
would
gardener.
disagree, but he's still cultivating relatively small. I do watch
Yeah.
his videos sometimes.
Yeah,
And
no, they're
I
good.
wouldn't want to be doing 30 acres that way.
No, absolutely not. But for half an acre, it's okay. But back to your bed guy, I think you mustn't forget that I'm sure you know the first line of defense plants, like the, I think, holly and holm oak and things like that. Even anything that's really tamarisk, really fine with heavy exposure, on that first 12 months of planting it, you will have to watch it a bit more. I would be tempted to put up some sort of netting to shelter it. I would water it more, infrequently, but maybe every week, just give it a good soak. And I think providing you put that TLC in that first 12 months, I think then you'll find that roses and things will grow if you choose the right ones, like the spinosissima and thing and the rugosa. But you'll need to take extra care for that first 12 months and maybe add lots of mulch to beef up your soil. Or is the soil pretty nice?
Well, I'm told by the locals that it is. I'm a bit skeptical. It doesn't look it looks a bit thin and stony, but it I'm sure it'll I mean anyway, like I said, I think the secret is to grow things that want to be there and to create tactical shelter belts and do
Yeah,
some
even if just
planting.
temporary.
Yeah, I mean, it's
Yeah.
interesting to watch the sheep in a gale, and they find themselves they tuck in underneath the thorns, and you get this, it looks really kind of cozy in there, and
Yeah.
the wind just sweeps over the top of them, and they're cozy underneath. So I hope to, and you get these beautifully sculpted bushes, by the wind,
Yeah, yeah.
and that in itself, I just love, and I like all the little tiny little micro habitats that you get as a result of those sort of microclimates around those topographical features. I just think it's just fascinating to look at what's growing there and why. And I think to try and work with that and mimic it, I'm looking forward to a very rewarding retirement there.
So you're going
Because
to become a
you spend
botanist in your
all
60s, and are you going to try and do a sort of Derek Jarman type one, and go
Well,
and when
maybe
you're
I do.
surfing on the beach, pick up the odd anchor and bit of driftwood and do something, because you are a maker, aren't you? I can
I
see you
do,
creating.
yeah. I do love making stuff, and yeah, and I'm very inspired by. I've never been to Derek Jarman's house, but I love his book and his poetry and what he's done with the garden there. I find pretty inspiring. I mean, ours will be, we're not on shingle. We're in the, it's God, I can't. It's a sort of schist, and I can't remember what the soil type is called, but it's pretty weird geography, which in itself is beautiful. I mean, it's anyway, I find myself fascinated by both the botany and the geology and the interacting kind of ecology of the area is absolutely fascinating. And to immerse myself in that and understand it and work with it, that will be what guides my gardening down there, I think. And I do find myself, I used to be just interested. If you couldn't eat it, I wasn't interested in it. But I am, I suppose, as I am less constrained by having to run a business, I find myself, perhaps embracing the aesthetic a bit more.
And so you'll be building raised beds, perhaps. So you will grow your own veg and herbs, perhaps.
Oh
Yeah.
yeah,
Yeah.
definitely, definitely. I don't think my wife will let me get away without having a good supply of vegetables. Part of the marriage contract.
And what about a couple of sun loungers and a hammock, or?
Oh yeah, no, I've always already set up the hammock, and you need various things for various wind directions down there. It's I don't know. God, I'm not. The guy who owned the cottage, he was very keen on, I don't know what the plant is. My wife describes it as a motorway services plant, but there is one, a sort of evergreen, probably part of the laurel family with a blue flower, that he used for all his windbreaks, which does seem to work very well. I don't like it very much. I would like to find something that looks a bit
Not
more
a
luxurious.
ceanothus.
Blue Flower, which has just finished, comes out in sort
Oh,
of very
no.
early March, April. Sort of laurelly, shiny leaf. Grows, I guess, to 4 or 5 foot high and quite a dense. It does look. It must be part of the rhododendron laurel family, I would say, looking at it.
I can't think what
I've never
no.
seen it anywhere else, but he's planted it all the way down there to and the bees just absolutely love it. I mean, they're drunk on it through April, which is must be invaluable for them. I don't think there's a lot else to feed them.
So are you going to keep that, the motorway shrub?
I'll have to learn to like it, I think. It does seem to be very
Yes. Oh, not necessarily, not necessarily.
beautiful.
Oh, that's really good. But no fire pit. Will you have a fire pit, or is that environmentally definitely not on the cards?
Probably have a fire pit, but no, I like sitting out around a fire. I mean, it's trying to create little areas where you can get tucked out of the wind because it is living there all the time. It's so funny, this house. I mean, it has just jaw-dropping views, but only one window facing the sea with all the windows. They were built as coast guard cottages, and I guess the guys spent the whole day looking at the sea. So all the windows face inland, but mainly because I guess it was very hard to keep a weatherproof window in the facing into a gale. So it's we probably will put in a few windows.
And so, for all those people listening who love growing vegetables, having the best organic vegetable grower in the country on the screen, how would you tell them then? What would you tell them for someone who wants to be fairly sustainable and grow their own veg? What would you tell them that aren't experts like you? What would you say are the
Okay.
best things you learned in your long vegetable growing history?
Well, assuming they're starting their efforts at growing and they want to get the maximum reward for the amount of effort that they can put in, I think going for, as many perennials as possible. So, if you've got lots of space, I mean, I'm a big fan of cardoons and artichokes, but they take up a ridiculous amount of space for what they produce. But, rhubarb and this perennial kales, I think, absolutely brilliant.
Your
Make sure.
Benton kale is the
Yeah,
perennial, isn't it, I think?
Taunton Dean is one. There's the Asturian cabbage as well, which is a slightly shorter lived. Taunton Dean seems to be the most. And there's one called, I think it's called Keeper as well, which Mandy is growing here on the farm, and that does seem to be more tender. Anyone who's interested in perennial vegetables, go to Incredible Vegetables, and they, though she's always selling out, there is a quite a call for them. And then, of the annuals that you are going to grow, I would always urge people to grow the cut and come again things, as we say, like perpetual spinach, the chards, a lot of rocket and mazuna and so on. You can grow like that, claytonia in the winter. Put yourself up a polytunnel, smallest poly, or at least some cold frames.
Will you do a polytunnel in your garden?
I probably will if I can tuck it away. It's an area of outstanding natural beauty. I feel sure there are going to be rules about polytunnels. There is a small greenhouse on the which I will I'm sort of renovating, though it's I think it's in the last days of its life. He was a very keen gardener.
But with the polytunnel, so I've just put one up here and I got them to cut the hoops right down because I do think they are made for giants. And when they are, it sort of 2.5 meters high, the hoop. And you don't need you. There's absolutely no reason you need anything than just above your head height. Do if you have the three-centered arch formation.
They're it's a much if you ask our staff, the ones who pick the tomatoes and cucumbers, we always pick our low tunnels first thing in the morning, 5, 6 o'clock. And when it's 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, they'll move into the higher ones because they're just so much more comfortable. They don't get so hot, and I think they're probably
Oh,
more
I
comfortable.
see.
I mean, if you can regulate, if you're there to control the ventilation, then perhaps that doesn't matter so much. But there are, it is commercially, people have just gone higher and higher and higher. I also have a farm in France where my neighbors, we have a hectare of tunnel there, and it must be about, I would say it must be almost 5 meters. And I think now they're in the Loire
Five
Valley,
meters high.
No, in the Loire Valley, they're going to 6 and 7 meters and 10 meter spans. And it is just a much more comfortable working atmosphere, and the plants are happier in there. You get less pest and disease and so on. So that's why commercially people have gone higher. But obviously they look hideous. I mean, it is
Really
a
hideous for miles.
it's a trade-off between the higher you go,
Yeah.
the more conspicuous it is. So it is a bit of a trade-off. And in the spring, actually, a lower one will warm more quickly.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's a benefit in the spring. Perhaps, and in the summer, we just leave our tend to leave them open at the ends all the time anyway.
Exactly.
And
Yeah.
this
And
time
mine's
of
shorter than yours, obviously, because yours are commercial,
year.
but with a shorter domestic tunnel, you don't get that massive heat build up in the centre, which you will obviously in your huge long ones
Well,
will.
we've got there, we try and make them 100 meters long now. And so that's, but the, we are one of the rare occasions when I'm grateful for Devon's slopes. I mean, if you can build them on a 10% slope, you get a kind of chimney effect. So as it starts warming up in there, the air wants to rise and it just rises chimney and through. And so
Very
you
clever.
accumulate. Yeah, no, it works fantastically well. It's totally low tech. People spend a fortune on ventilation and greenhouses. If you've got a slope, you really don't need it. You just open a, a window at the top and the bottom, and it maintains a pretty even temperature.
Fascinating. Never realized that. Another top tip then for the growers. So, what are the most unusual things that you can grow easily at home that you can't buy? What would you put into that category? I think artichokes probably is one because you cannot buy the
Artichokes.
small artichokes
You
globes.
can't buy the So if you want to go and grow the, I guess I would urge people to eat the whole thing rather than so go
I
maybe
love.
go, yeah, go for a violet variety. They also tend to be a little bit smaller, so you can put them in closer. And opal is the one that I know. There are lots of other ones as well. And yeah, you only have to buy them once, and then you can propagate from suckers for
Yeah.
thereafter. Weird things. Well, I mean, I am. I suppose this is no. This is that's getting into sort of foraging. I
What is
don't
it though?
know. Well, I am. I there's so many plants I've noticed down, at the cottage. I mean, there are. I mean, I love strong flavors. I mean, people, so, the rock samphire, which is probably coming to the end of its season now. It's probably at its best in March and April. It gets a bit coarse afterwards. I think it's beautiful with potatoes. And I've been experimenting with eating the Alexanders as well, which the
Yeah.
Romans brought here. And that, I mean, it's a really interesting flavor. And the seeds you can use as a sort of pepper substitute. I think that has
How do you
some.
use the Alexanders? You leave use the leaves or the stem? I mean, you can eat them all, can't you?
You can eat the whole thing at different stages. I'm not an expert. This is the first year that I've been experimenting. I've been just spreading a few of the young leaves from the center of the plant. I just use them in a salad. So,
Yeah.
but I haven't gone to the stalks yet. It's, of course, it is part of the same family as hemlock and so on. So one needs to be a little bit careful. So advising anyone to pick it, be very careful. Look it up. They are fairly easy to identify, but just do make sure you've got the right one.
Yeah.
I mean, all the sort of foraging things, and I think we do need to get back to eating. I heard someone on the radio going on about, the most of the vegetables that we bred out all those phytonutrients, which are, protecting our health, in the breeding process of making them sweet and tender, and then growing them, pushing them on with lots of water and nitrogen fertilizer. We've lost so much of that. But of course, in these wild plants, but they haven't been bred out yet. And those strong flavors, to me, are indicative of some of the phytonutrients that will protect us from cancer. And we do need to and look after, keep our biomes healthy. I'm not really answering your question, am I? Odd things, unusual things that you might grow that you can't buy. Well, I don't actually, there's nothing unusual about a courgette, but if you grow a courgette yourself and eat it, when it's freshly picked, it is just a different thing. I mean, you can eat it like a cucumber. I mean, it has a completely different flavor to something that's been through the cold chain and, might be, you can keep a courgette for a month in a cold room at 2 degrees centigrade and 95% humidity, and the consumer, picking it up off a supermarket shelf wouldn't know, but it would taste of absolutely nothing and probably have almost zero nutritional value as well. So I think look, super fresh courgettes, and then you can, of course, you can eat the flowers, stuff the flowers. There are lots of wonderful Greek recipes for stuffed courgette flowers. They can be really beautiful, and of course they're dead easy. It's one of those you only have to plant it once in the season, and you know, it can be a wonderful vegetable, which everyone's always desperate to get rid of come the end of July through August.
Oh, I'm not. I could eat them forever, courgettes and
Yeah,
beans.
no,
Love
yeah.
them. So many different. I think it's just that we're a bit limited on our imagination because you can do so many different things with them.
I think they are
And grate them
wonderful.
and make them into pasta
Yeah,
and
yeah.
all that sort of thing. So
If
there's
you're
loads of
really
stuff.
late, if you're really lazy and you've got a big garden, I mean, just grow some squash. And the ones that I would always grow would be Crown Prince. I mean, they are the best, and they will keep all the way through, you know, till the next summer. I mean, they've got such hard skins, and they're the best flavored. You know, you do sometimes need a chainsaw to get into them. I mean, they're
But
quite.
do you cook them with the skins on with the Crown Prince?
Yeah, you can. That's the easiest way to deal with them. Don't put them in the oven whole; they will explode. You know,
Oh,
so cut.
really?
Oh yeah, even though you'll have a long time cleaning your oven if you do that. So cut them in half. Yeah, and maybe just scoop out the seeds. Maybe just brush them with a bit of olive oil. Yeah, and roast them until they're soft, and then scoop them out and use them in a soup, a risotto, or whatever, a gnocchi, or whatever you're hoping to do with it. They are the best flavored, the best keeping, the easiest to grow. They're reasonably early to mature, and they're very, very hardy and vigorous. Yeah, so yeah,
And they're
grow them,
beautiful, aren't they? They've got the
and then
bluey
yeah,
color.
slightly kind of silvery gray blue skin. And Crown Prince is just about the Blue Hubbard is the type that you're looking for. Crown Prince is probably the most common variety.
No, lovely. And parsnips, we always get questions about this. Why don't my parsnips germinate? But I think parsnips, parsley,
Very difficult crop to grow
and
parsnips. I mean, really, you are setting yourself a challenge, I would say, growing a parsnip in a garden. I mean, you've got carrot, root fly, canker. They're absolute pigs to get to germinate evenly. You know,
but even
they're
with the F1,
growing.
even with Gladiator and Countess, the F1 hybrids that are
Yeah.
so vigorous, you can sow them when it's warmer, so you get a quicker germination and they still root up and bulk up.
I think they're still quite a difficult vegetable to grow, and celeriac, part of the same umbrella family, I think is also very difficult to grow in a garden. I mean, very demanding in terms of its growing conditions. If you want a challenge, by all means go for it, but I think there are a lot more rewarding things to grow.
Oh my. Well, I find with these new F1 varieties, it's sort of revolutionized it because I think they
Yeah.
take 2 weeks. The seed is not ripe when you sow it, is it? You sow it and it has 2 weeks before the embryo fully ripens in the ground, and then it starts to germinate. So it is
Okay.
prey to all sorts of
Yeah.
things. And that
Well,
is the problem, isn't it?
you
It's keeping it moist.
sound like you're very good at it, Bunny. I have to say I gave up. We did have some wonderful crops of parsnips, but I did slightly despair of it. Yeah, getting them to germinate. And they have now, what do they call it? Pre-germ, they soak it.
Pre-treated.
Yeah, they soak it and then dry it out, and then that will go off quicker again. But yeah, no, they're difficult. And then you grow them, and then they get. I mean, it's quite common, and we're quite damp in Devon for them to get canker as well.
We don't get that over here because it's
Yeah,
drier, obviously, I think. Oh, right. That you disappoint me, guy. I thought you'd have them growing everywhere with no problems at all.
Well, I would much, if I want a sweet, starchy vegetable, I would rather eat a Crown Prince squash, I suppose. So maybe they're not my favourite vegetable either. So, yeah.
Right. Well, thank you very much indeed for coming on the podcast. That's fascinating. Good luck with your new garden. I bet it looks
Thank you, Bunny. And
fantastic.
we
And you'll
will.
do it evenly, you and Geeti. Would you? You'll have evenness on design and work and
Oh,
everything, the joint effort.
yeah, we do. I remember we'll probably have a few arguments. We did have a bit of a dispute about the asparagus bed, and I followed, as you, Charles Dowding's advice for no dig gardening. In the end, we put down the cardboard and compost, and we'll see how they do. It's Yeah, I don't
When did
think
you
just
put them in? This year? Or last
yeah,
August?
way too
September?
late. No, I put them in, relatively recently. They'd been actually they came off someone who planned to plant them commercially, and he had all these crowns. and he just gave them to me, but they're way too late, so they're not even up yet. So I feel reasonably confident they will still come, but no, should have been planted much sooner.
They are a fantastic crop, perennial crop that's easy, isn't it? Pretty easy, really, apart from the asparagus beetle. Or don't you grow commercial asparagus, do you?
Well, as a matter of fact, asparagus is one of the most challenging crops organically, and I always said I'd save it for my as a retirement project. So there we go. I'm approaching retirement, and I've finally planted some. I did plant some about 20 years ago, and it was just consumed by slugs. I don't know whether you find that a problem, but the
No.
emerging spears, every one of them was just, if not destroyed, damaged by slugs.
And you wouldn't
Hopefully
use
not
an
this time.
organic slug pellet. So you wouldn't use a ferric
We
phosphate
do
pulp slug
use,
pellet.
yes, we do use some of those in the tunnels. I don't think we've ever used them commercially outside. And I'm not sh it seems to be a problem. I have to say, I'm not that connected with what's going on in the tunnels these days, but I don't think they are using anymore. I think the problem has abated. It seems to come and go. We used to have a flock of geese which we put in, ducks, and after we took the straw, the tomatoes out, or peppers, cucumbers, chilies, when you lifted up the ground cover and then put the ducks in, and they just feasted on on the slugs and their eggs, actually. That was very useful.
Interesting, because when I tried feeding my ducks, I took them out little sort of bowls of slugs and stuff, and they looked at me as if I was bonkers. But I think it does depend on the ducks, doesn't
I think
it?
it does depend on the duck. Yeah, these were runner ducks that were actually, we did have some muscovies as well. People said calder. You want something quite small,
A
that's not
cool
going to be
duck. Mine
big.
were cool ducks, and they didn't like them.
Oh,
I
they
think I fed
didn't.
them too well. I do use the ferric phosphate slug pellets, but I think people tend to just throw them down too much, and you only need a few, and then you just see if the slugs take them the first night, and then put a few more if they do, and then you probably don't need any after that too. And sometimes you really don't need them at all. But things like aubergines, peppers, I just find they're so subject to just nibbling their stalks, and it knackers the whole plant in seconds.
If I would always encourage anyone putting up a tunnel to put them up with the sides dug in rather than with a ground rail, and then that stops the constant influx.
Infiltration of slugs.
And it's cheaper and easier to put up a tunnel that way. It's more resistant to being blown away, and that's how I would always put a tunnel up. I hate the ground rails things, and you've always got stuff coming in underneath. So dig the sides in if you can.
Okay, lovely. Well, thank you very much indeed. It's been lovely hearing about it. I look forward to see your garden, your Derek Jarman-like garden in extensive spreads of Gardens Illustrated and all the magazines soon. So I'm sure you'll be a very good grower when you adapt to ornamentals more, because you've obviously got a good eye, I would think, and Geetie definitely has, hasn't she, with her vestrons and things.
She's the aesthetic for us both, I think. But yeah, no, come and see us in Devon, Bunny.
And when you're next up visiting
Oh,
Sacwell,
exactly. I will, yes, in September.
drop me a line and come over, and you can give me some advice on my vegetables and my pigs and cows and sheep and ducks and everything.
Wow. Well, I look forward to that.
Lovely. Anyway, thank you very much
All
indeed.
right.
Bye.
Bye.